Mrs. Hummel told him she was poor and had tried to cure baby herself, but now it was too late and she could only ask him to help the others and trust to charity for his pay. He smiled then and was kinder, but it was very sad, and I cried with him till he turned round all of a sudden and told me to go home and take Belladonna right away, or I'd have the fever. "No, you won't," cried Jo, hugging her close with a frightened look. "Oh, Beth, if you should be sick, I never could forgive myself. What shall we do?" "Don't be frightened. I guess I shan't have it badly. I looked in Mother's book and saw that it begins with headache, sore throat, and queer feelings like mine, so I did take some Belladonna, and I feel better," said Beth, laying her cold hands on her hot forehead and trying to look well. "If Mother was only at home," exclaimed Jo, seizing the book and feeling that Washington was an immense way off. She read a page, looked at Beth, felt her head, peeped into her throat, and then said gravely, "You've been over the baby every day for more than a week, and among the others who are going to have it, so I'm afraid you are going to have it, Beth. I'll call Hannah. She knows all about sickness." "Don't let Amy come. She never had it, and I should hate to give it to her. Can't you and Meg have it over again?" asked Beth anxiously. "I guess not. Don't care if I do. Serve me right, selfish pig, to let you go and stay writing rubbish myself," muttered Jo, as she went to consult Hannah. The good soul was wide awake in a minute and took the lead at once, assuring that there was no need to worry. Everyone had scarlet fever, and if rightly treated, nobody died, all of which Jo believed and felt much relieved as they went up to call Meg. "Now I'll tell you what we'll do," said Hannah when she had examined and questioned Beth. "We will have Dr. Bangs just to take a look at you, dear, and see that we start right. Then we'll send Amy off to Aunt March's for a spell to keep her out of harm's way, and one of you girls can stay at home and amuse Beth for a day or two." "I shall stay, of course. I am oldest," began Meg, looking anxious and self-reproachful. "I shall, because it's my fault she is sick. I told Mother I'd do the errands, and I haven't," said Jo decidedly. "Which will you have, Beth? There ain't no need of but one," said Hannah. "Jo, please." And Beth leaned her head against her sister with a contented look, which effectually settled that point. "I'll go and tell Amy," said Meg, feeling a little hurt, yet rather relieved on the whole, for she did not like nursing, and Jo did. Amy rebelled outright and passionately declared that she'd rather have the fever than go to Aunt March. Meg reasoned, pleaded, and commanded, all in vain. Amy protested that she would not go, and Meg left her in despair to ask Hannah what should be done. Before she came back, Lori walked into the parlor to find Amy sobbing, with her head in the sofa cushions. She told her story, expecting to be consoled, but Lori only put his hands in his pockets and walked about the room, whistling softly as he knit his brows in deep thought. Presently he sat down beside her and said, in his most wheedlesome tone, "Now be a sensible little woman and do as they say. No, don't cry, but hear what a jolly plan I've got. You go to Aunt March's and I'll come and take you out every day, driving or walking, and we'll have capital times. Won't that be better than moping here?"
"I don't wish to be sent off as if I was in the way," began Amy in an injured voice.
"Bless your heart, child, it's to keep you well. You don't want to be sick, do you?"
"No, I'm sure I don't, but I dare say I shall be, for I've been with Beth all the time."
"That's the very reason you ought to go away at once, so that you may escape it. Change of air and care will keep you well, I dare say, or if it does not entirely, you will have the fever more lightly. I advise you to be off as soon as you can, for scarlet fever is no joke, miss."
"But it's dull at Aunt March's, and she is so cross," said Amy, looking rather frightened.
"It won't be dull with me popping in every day to tell you how Beth is and take you out gallivanting. The old lady likes me, and I'll be as sweet as possible to her, so she won't peck at us, whatever we do."
"Will you take me out in the trotting wagon with Puck?"
"On my honor as a gentleman."
"And come every single day?"
"See if I don't."
"And bring me back the minute Beth is well?"
"The identical minute."
"And go to the theater, truly?"
"A dozen theaters, if we may."
"Well, I guess I will," said Amy slowly.
Good girl. Call Meg and tell her you'll give in, said Laurie with an approving pat, which annoyed Amy more than the giving in.
Meg and Joe came running down to behold the miracle which had been wrought, and Amy, feeling very precious and self-sacrificing, promised to go if the doctor said Beth was going to be ill.
How is the little dear? Asked Laurie, for Beth was his especial pet, and he felt more anxious about her than he liked to show.
She is lying down on Mother's bed and feels better. The baby's death troubled her, but I dare say she's only got cold. Hannah says she thinks so, but she looks worried, and that makes me fidgety, answered Meg.
What a trying world it is, said Joe, rumpling up her hair in a fretful way. No sooner do we get out of one trouble than down comes another. There doesn't seem to be anything to hold on to when Mother's gone, so I'm all at sea.
Well, don't make a porcupine of yourself. It isn't becoming. Settle your wig, Joe, and tell me if I shall telegraph to your mother, or do anything, asked Laurie,
who had never been reconciled to the loss of his friend's one beauty.
That is what troubles me, said Meg. I think we ought to tell her if Beth is really ill, but Hannah says we mustn't, for Mother can't leave Father, and it will only make them anxious. Beth won't be sick long, and Hannah knows just what to do, and Mother said we were to mind her, so I suppose we must, but it doesn't seem quite right to me.
Well, I can't say. Suppose you ask Grandfather after the doctor has been.
We will. Joe, go and get Dr. Bangs at once, commanded Meg. We can't decide anything till he has been.
Stay where you are, Joe. I'm errand boy to this establishment, said Laurie, taking up his cap.
I'm afraid you are busy, began Meg.
No, I've done my lessons for the day.
Do you study in vacation time? Asked Joe.
I follow the good example my neighbors set me, was Laurie's answer, as he swung himself out of the room.
I have great hopes for my boy, observed Joe, watching him fly over the fence with an approving smile. He does very well for a boy, was Meg's somewhat ungracious answer, for the subject did not interest her.
Dr. Bangs came, said Beth had symptoms of the fever, but he thought she would have it lightly, though he looked sober over the Hummel story. Amy was ordered off at once, and, provided with something to ward off danger, she departed in great state, with Joe and Laurie as escort. Aunt March received them with her usual hospitality.
"What do you want now?" she asked, looking sharply over her spectacles, while the parrot, sitting on the back of her chair, called out,
"Go away! No boys allowed here."
Laurie retired to the window, and Joe told her story.
"No more than I expected, if you are allowed to go poking about among poor folks. Amy can stay and make herself useful if she isn't sick, which I've no doubt she will be. Looks like it now."
Don't cry, child. It worries me to hear people sniff.
Amy was on the point of crying, but Laurie slyly pulled the parrot's tail, which caused Polly to utter an astonished croak and call out,
"Bless my boots,"
in such a funny way that she laughed instead.
"What do you hear from your mother?" asked the old lady gruffly.
"Father is much better," replied Joe, trying to keep sober.
"Oh, is he? Well, that won't last long, I fancy. March never had any stamina," was the cheerful reply.
"Ha ha! Never say die. Take a pinch of snuff. Goodbye, goodbye," squalled Polly, dancing on her perch and clawing at the old lady's cap as Laurie tweaked him in the rear.
"Hold your tongue, you disrespectful old bird. And Joe, you'd better go at once. It isn't proper to be gadding about so late with a rattle-pated boy like..."
"Hold your tongue, you disrespectful old bird," cried Polly,
tumbling off the chair with a bounce and running to peck the rattle-pated boy, who was shaking with laughter at the last speech.
"I don't think I can bear it, but I'll try," thought Amy, as she was left alone with Aunt March.
"Get along, you fright," screamed Polly,
and at that rude speech, Amy could not restrain a sniff. Chapter 18. Dark Days. Beth did have the fever, and was much sicker than anyone but Hannah and the doctor suspected. The girls knew nothing about illness, and Mr. Lawrence was not allowed to see her, so Hannah had everything her own way, and busy Dr. Bangs did his best, but left a good deal to the excellent nurse. Meg stayed at home, lest she should infect the Kings, and kept house, feeling very anxious, and a little guilty when she wrote letters in which no mention was made of Beth's illness. She could not think it right to deceive her mother, but she had been bidden to mind Hannah, and Hannah wouldn't hear of Mrs. March being told and worried just for such a trifle. Jo devoted herself to Beth day and night, not a hard task, for Beth was very patient and bore her pain uncomplainingly, as long as she could control herself. But there came a time when, during the fever fits, she began to talk in a hoarse, broken voice, to play on the coverlet as if on her beloved little piano, and try to sing with a throat so swollen that there was no music left, a time when she did not know the familiar faces around her, but addressed them by wrong names and called imploringly for her mother. Then Jo grew frightened. Meg begged to be allowed to write the truth, and even Hannah, said she, would think of it, though there was no danger yet. A letter from Washington added to their trouble, for Mr. March had had a relapse and could not think of coming home for a long while. How dark the day seemed now, how sad and lonely the house, and how heavy were the hearts of the sisters as they worked and waited while the shadow of death hovered over the once happy home. Then it was that Margaret, sitting alone with tears dropping often on her work, felt how rich she had been in things more precious than any luxuries money could buy, in love, protection, peace, and health, the real blessings of life. Then it was that Jo, living in the darkened room, with that suffering little sister always before her eyes and that pathetic voice sounding in her ears, learned to see the beauty and the sweetness of Beth's nature, to feel how deep and tender a place she filled in all hearts, and to acknowledge the worth of Beth's unselfish ambition to live for others and make home happy by that exercise of those simple virtues which all may possess and which all should love and value more than talent, wealth, or beauty. And Amy, in her exile, longed eagerly to be at home, that she might work for Beth, feeling now that no service would be hard or irksome, and remembering, with regretful grief, how many neglected tasks those willing hands had done for her. Lori haunted the house like a restless ghost, and Mr. Lawrence locked the grand piano, because he could not bear to be reminded of the young neighbor who used to make the twilight pleasant for him. Everyone missed Beth. The milkman, baker, grocer, and butcher inquired how she did. Poor Mrs. Hummel came to beg pardon for her thoughtlessness and to get a shroud for Mina. The neighbors sent all sorts of comforts and good wishes, and even those who knew her best were surprised to find how many friends shy little Beth had made. Meanwhile, she lay on her bed with old Joanna at her side, for even in her wanderings she did not forget her forlorn protege. She longed for her cats, but would not have them brought, lest they should get sick, and in her quiet hours she was full of anxiety about Jo. She sent loving messages to Amy, bade them tell her mother that she would write soon, and often begged for pencil and paper to try to say a word that father might not think she had neglected him. But soon even these intervals of consciousness ended, and she lay hour after hour, tossing to and fro, with incoherent words on her lips, or sank into a heavy sleep which brought her no refreshment. Dr. Bangs came twice a day. Hannah sat up at night. Meg kept a telegram in her desk, all ready to send off at any minute, and Jo never stirred from Beth's side. The 1st of December was a wintry day indeed to them, for a bitter wind blew, snow fell fast, and the year seemed getting ready for its death. When Dr. Bangs came that morning, he looked long at Beth, held the hot hand in both his own for a minute, and laid it gently down, saying in a low voice to Hannah,
"If Mrs. March can leave her husband, she'd better be sent for."
Hannah nodded without speaking, for her lips twitched nervously. Meg dropped down into a chair as the strength seemed to go out of her limbs at the sound of those words, and Jo, standing with a pale face for a minute, ran to the parlor, snatched up the telegram, and throwing on her things, rushed out into the storm. She was soon back, and while noiselessly taking off her cloak, Lori came in with a letter, saying that Mr. March was mending again. Jo read it thankfully, but the heavy weight did not seem lifted off her heart, and her face was so full of misery that Lori asked quickly,
"What is it? Is Beth worse?"
"I've sent for Mother," said Jo, tugging at her rubber boots with a tragic expression.
"Good for you, Jo. Did you do it on your own responsibility?" asked Lori,
as he seated her in the hall chair and took off the rebellious boots, seeing how her hands shook.
"No, the doctor told us to." "Oh, Jo, it's not so bad as that. cried Lori with a startled face.
Yes, it is. She doesn't know us. She doesn't even talk about the flocks of green doves, as she calls the vine leaves on the wall. She doesn't look like my Beth, and there's nobody to help us bear it. Mother and father both gone, and God seems so far away. I can't find him.
As the tears streamed fast down poor Joe's cheeks, she stretched out her hand in a helpless sort of way, as if groping in the dark, and Lori took it in his, whispering as well as he could with a lump in his throat.
I'm here. Hold on to me, Joe dear.
She could not speak, but she did hold on, and the warm grasp of the friendly human hand comforted her sore heart and seemed to lead her nearer to the divine arm, which alone could uphold her in her trouble. Lori longed to say something tender and comfortable, but no fitting words came to him, so he stood silent, gently stroking her bent head, as her mother used to do. It was the best thing he could have done, far more soothing than the most eloquent words, for Joe felt the unspoken sympathy, and in the silence learned the sweet solace which affection administers to sorrow. Soon she dried the tears which had relieved her and looked up with a grateful face.
Thank you, Teddy. I'm better now. I don't feel so forlorn, and will try to bear it if it comes.
Keep hoping for the best. That will help you, Joe. Soon your mother will be here, and then everything will be all right.
I'm so glad Father is better. Now she won't feel so bad about leaving him. Oh, me, it does seem as if all the troubles came in a heap, and I got the heaviest part on my shoulders, sighed Joe, spreading her wet handkerchief over her knees to dry.
Doesn't Meg pull fair? Asked Lori, looking indignant.
Oh, yes, she tries to, but she can't love Bethy as I do, and she won't miss her as I shall. Beth is my conscience, and I can't give her up. I can't. I can't.
Down went Joe's face into the wet handkerchief, and she cried despairingly, for she'd kept up bravely till now and never shed a tear. Lori drew his hand across his eyes, but could not speak till he had subdued the choky feeling in his throat and steadied his lips. It might be unmanly, but he couldn't help it, and I am glad of it. Presently, as Joe's sobs quieted, he said hopefully,
I don't think she will die. She's so good, and we all love her so much. I don't believe God will take her away yet.
The good and dear people always do die, groaned Joe,
but she stopped crying, for her friend's words cheered her up, in spite of her own doubts and fears.
Poor girl, you're worn out. It isn't like you to be forlorn. Stop a bit. I'll hearten you up in a jiffy.
Lori went off two stairs at a time, and Joe laid her wearied head down on Beth's little brown hood, which no one had thought of moving from the table where she left it. It must have possessed some magic, for the submissive spirit of its gentle owner seemed to enter into Joe, and when Lori came running down with a glass of wine, she took it with a smile and said bravely,
I drink. Health to my Beth. You are a good doctor, Teddy, and such a comfortable friend. How can I ever pay you? She added, as the wine refreshed her body, as the kind words had done her troubled mind.
I'll send my bill by and by, and tonight I'll give you something that will warm the cockles of your heart better than quarts of wine, said Lori,
beaming at her with a face of suppressed satisfaction at something.
What is it? Cried Joe,
forgetting her woes for a minute in her wonder.
I telegraphed to your mother yesterday, and Brooke answered she'd come at once, and she'll be here tonight, and everything will be all right. Aren't you glad I did it?
Lori spoke very fast, and turned red and excited all in a minute, for he'd kept his plot a secret, for fear of disappointing the girls or harming Beth. Joe grew quite white, flew out of her chair, and the moment he stopped speaking, she electrified him by throwing her arms round his neck and crying out with a joyful cry,
Oh, Lori! Oh, Mother! I am so glad!
She did not weep again, but laughed hysterically, and trembled and clung to her friend, as if she was a little bewildered by the sudden news. Lori, though decidedly amazed, behaved with great presence of mind. He patted her back soothingly, and finding that she was recovering, followed it up by a bashful kiss or two, which brought Joe round at once. Holding on to the banisters, she put him gently away, saying breathlessly,
Oh, don't! I didn't mean to. It was dreadful of me. But you were such a dear to go and do it, in spite of Hannah, that I couldn't help flying at you. Tell me all about it, and don't give me wine again. It makes me act so.
I don't mind, laughed Lori as he settled his tie. Why, you see, I got fidgety, and so did Grandpa. We thought Hannah was overdoing the authority business, and your mother ought to know.
She'd never forgive us if Beth... well, if anything happened, you know. So I got Grandpa to say it was high time we did something, and off I pelted to the office yesterday, for the doctor looked sober, and Hannah most took my head off when I proposed a telegram. I never can bear to be lorded over, so that settled my mind, and I did it. Your mother will come, I know, and the late train is in at 2 a.m. I shall go for her, and you've only got to bottle up your rapture and keep Beth quiet till that blessed lady gets here.
Lori, you're an angel. How shall I ever thank you?
Fly at me again. I rather liked it, said Lori, looking mischievous, a thing he had not done for a fortnight.
No, thank you. I'll do it by proxy when your grandpa comes. Don't tease, but go home and rest, for you'll be up half the night. Bless you, Teddy. Bless you.
Jo had backed into a corner, and as she finished her speech, she vanished precipitately into the kitchen, where she sat down upon a dresser and told the assembled cats that she was
happy, oh, so happy,
while Lori departed, feeling that he'd made rather a neat thing of it.
That's the interferingest chap I ever see, but I forgive him and do hope Mrs. March is coming right away, said Hannah with an air of relief when Jo told the good news.
Meg had a quiet rapture and then brooded over the letter, while Jo set the sick room in order, and Hannah knocked up a couple of pies in case of company unexpected. A breath of fresh air seemed to blow through the house, and something better than sunshine brightened the quiet rooms. Everything appeared to feel the hopeful change. Beth's bird began to chirp again, and a half-blown rose was discovered on Amy's bush in the window. The fire seemed to burn with unusual cheeriness, and every time the girls met, their pale faces broke into smiles as they hugged one another, whispering encouragingly,
"Mother's coming, dear. Mother's coming."
Everyone rejoiced but Beth. She lay in that heavy stupor, alike unconscious of hope and joy, doubt and danger. It was a piteous sight, the once rosy face so changed and vacant, the once busy hands so weak and wasted, the once smiling lips quite dumb, and the once pretty, well-kept hair scattered rough and tangled on the pillow. All day she lay so, only rousing now and then to mutter,
"Water,"
with lips so parched they could hardly shape the word. All day Jo and Meg hovered over her, watching, waiting, hoping, and trusting in God and Mother, and all day the snow fell, the bitter wind raged, and the hours dragged slowly by. But night came at last, and every time the clock struck, the sisters, still sitting on either side of the bed, looked at each other with brightening eyes, for each hour brought help nearer. The doctor had been in to say that some change, for better or worse, would probably take place about midnight, at which time he would return. Hannah, quite worn out, lay down on the sofa at the bed's foot and fell fast asleep. Mr. Lawrence marched to and fro in the parlor, feeling that he would rather face a rebel battery than Mrs. March's countenance as she entered. Lori lay on the rug, pretending to rest, but staring into the fire with a thoughtful look which made his black eyes beautifully soft and clear. The girls never forgot that night, for no sleep came to them as they kept their watch, with that dreadful sense of powerlessness which comes to us in hours like those.
"If God spares Beth, I never will complain again," whispered Meg earnestly.
"If God spares Beth, I'll try to love and serve him all my life," answered Jo, with equal fervor.
"I wish I had no heart. It aches so," sighed Meg, after a pause.
"If life is often as hard as this, I don't see how we ever shall get through it," added her sister despondently.
Here the clock struck 12, and both forgot themselves in watching Beth, for they fancied a change passed over her wan face. The house was still as death, and nothing but the wailing of the wind broke the deep hush. Weary Hannah slept on, and no one but the sisters saw the pale shadow which seemed to fall upon the little bed. An hour went by, and nothing happened except Lori's quiet departure for the station. Another hour, still no one came, and anxious fears of delay in the storm, or accidents by the way, or, worst of all, a great grief at Washington, haunted the girls. It was past 2 when Jo, who stood at the window, thinking how dreary the world looked in its winding sheet of snow, heard a movement by the bed, and turning quickly, saw Meg kneeling before their mother's easy chair with her face hidden. A dreadful fear passed coldly over Jo as she thought, "Beth is dead, and Meg is afraid to tell me."
She was back at her post in an instant, and to her excited eyes, a great change seemed to have taken place. The fever flush and the look of pain were gone, and the beloved little face looked so pale and peaceful in its utter repose that Jo felt no desire to weep or to lament. Leaning low over this dearest of her sisters, she kissed the damp forehead with her heart on her lips and softly whispered, "Goodbye, my Beth. Goodbye." As if awaked by the stir, Hannah started out of her sleep, hurried to the bed, looked at Beth, felt her hands, listened at her lips, and then, throwing her apron over her head, sat down to rock to and fro, exclaiming under her breath, "The favor's turned. She's sleeping natural. Her skin's damp, and she breathes easy. Praise be given. Oh, my goodness me." Before the girls could believe the happy truth, the doctor came to confirm it. He was a homely man, but they thought his face quite heavenly when he smiled and said, with a fatherly look at them,
"Yes, my dears, I think the little girl will pull through this time. Keep the house quiet, let her sleep, and when she wakes, give her..."
What they were to give, neither heard, for both crept into the dark hall and, sitting on the stairs, held each other close, rejoicing, with hearts too full for words. When they went back to be kissed and cuddled by faithful Hannah, they found Beth lying, as she used to do, with her cheek pillowed on her hand, the dreadful pallor gone, and breathing quietly, as if just fallen asleep.
"If Mother would only come now," said Jo, as the winter night began to wane.
"See," said Meg, coming up with a white, half-opened rose. "I thought this would hardly be ready to lay in Beth's hand tomorrow if she went away from us. But it has blossomed in the night, and now I mean to put it in my vase here, so that when the darling wakes, the first thing she sees will be the little rose and Mother's face." Never had the sun risen so beautifully, and never had the world seemed so lovely as it did to the heavy eyes of Meg and Jo, as they looked out in the early morning when their long, sad vigil was done.
"It looks like a fairy world," said Meg, smiling to herself as she stood behind the curtain, watching the dazzling sight.
"Hark!" cried Jo, starting to her feet. Yes, there was a sound of bells at the door below, a cry from Hannah, and then Lori's voice saying in a joyful whisper,
"Girls, she's come! She's come!"
Chapter 19. Amy's Will. While these things were happening at home, Amy was having hard times at Aunt March's. She felt her exile deeply, and for the first time in her life realized how much she was beloved and petted at home. Aunt March never petted anyone. She did not approve of it, but she meant to be kind, for the well-behaved little girl pleased her very much, and Aunt March had a soft place in her old heart for her nephew's children, though she didn't think it proper to confess it. She really did her best to make Amy happy, but dear me, what mistakes she made. Some old people keep young at heart, in spite of wrinkles and gray hairs, can sympathize with children's little cares and joys, make them feel at home, and can hide wise lessons under pleasant plays, giving and receiving friendship in the sweetest way. But Aunt March had not this gift, and she worried Amy very much with her rules and orders, her prim ways, and long, prosy talks. Finding the child more docile and amiable than her sister, the old lady felt it her duty to try and counteract, as far as possible, the bad effects of home freedom and indulgence. So she took Amy by the hand and taught her as she herself had been taught 60 years ago, a process which carried dismay to Amy's soul and made her feel like a fly in the web of a very strict spider. She had to wash the cups every morning and polish up the old-fashioned spoons, the fat silver teapot, and the glasses till they shone. Then she must dust the room, and what a trying job that was. Not a speck escaped Aunt March's eye, and all the furniture had claw legs and much carving, which was never dusted to suit. Then Polly had to be fed, the lap dog combed, and a dozen trips upstairs and down to get things or deliver orders, for the old lady was very lame and seldom left her big chair. After these tiresome labors, she must do her lessons, which was a daily trial of every virtue she possessed. Then she was allowed 1 hour for exercise or play. And didn't she enjoy it? Lori came every day and wheedled Aunt March till Amy was allowed to go out with him, when they walked and rode and had capital times. After dinner, she had to read aloud, and sit still while the old lady slept, which she usually did for an hour as she dropped off over the first page. Then patchwork or towels appeared, and Amy sewed with outward meekness and inward rebellion till dusk, when she was allowed to amuse herself as she liked till tea time. The evenings were the worst of all, for Aunt March fell to telling long stories about her youth, which were so unutterably dull that Amy was always ready to go to bed, intending to cry over her hard fate, but usually going to sleep before she had squeezed out more than a tear or two. If it had not been for Lori and old Esther, the maid, she felt that she never could have got through that dreadful time. The parrot alone was enough to drive her distracted, for he soon felt that she did not admire him, and revenged himself by being as mischievous as possible. He pulled her hair whenever she came near him, upset his bread and milk to plague her when she newly cleaned his cage, made Mop bark by pecking at him while Madam dozed, called her names before company, and behaved in all respects like a reprehensible old bird. Then she could not endure the dog, a fat cross beast who snarled and yelped at her when she made his toilet, and who lay on his back with all his legs in the air, and a most idiotic expression of countenance when he wanted something to eat, which was about a dozen times a day. The cook was bad-tempered, the old coachman was deaf, and Esther the only one who ever took any notice of the young lady. Esther was a Frenchwoman who had lived with Madame, as she called her mistress, for many years, and who rather tyrannized over the old lady, who could not get along without her. Her real name was Estelle, but Aunt March ordered her to change it, and she obeyed, on condition that she was never asked to change her religion. She took a fancy to Mademoiselle, and amused her very much with odd stories of her life in France, when Amy sat with her while she got up Madame's laces. She also allowed her to roam about the great house and examine the curious and pretty things stored away in the big wardrobes in the ancient chests, for Aunt March hoarded like a magpie. Amy's chief delight was an Indian cabinet, full of queer drawers, little pigeonholes, and secret places, in which were kept all sorts of ornaments, some precious, some merely curious, all more or less antique. To examine and arrange these things gave Amy great satisfaction, especially the jewel cases, in which, on velvet cushions, reposed the ornaments which had adorned a bell 40 years ago. There was the garnet set which Aunt March wore when she came out, the pearls her father gave her on her wedding day, her lover's diamonds, the jet mourning rings and pins, the queer lockets with portraits of dead friends and weeping willows made of hair inside, the baby bracelets her one little daughter had worn, Uncle March's big watch with the red seal so many childish hands had played with, and in a box all by itself lay Aunt March's wedding ring, too small now for her fat finger, but put carefully away like the most precious jewel of them all. "Which would Mademoiselle choose if she had her will?" asked Esther, who always sat near to watch over and lock up the valuables.
"I like the diamonds best, but there is no necklace among them, and I'm fond of necklaces. They are so becoming." "I should choose this, if I might," replied Amy, looking with great admiration at a string of gold and ebony beads, from which hung a heavy cross of the same.
"I, too, covet that, but not as a necklace. Ah, no. To me it is a rosary, and as such I should use it like a good Catholic," said Esther, eyeing the handsome thing wistfully.
"Is it meant to use as you use the string of good-smelling wooden beads hanging over your glass?" asked Amy.
"Truly, yes, to pray with. It would be pleasing to the saints if one used so fine a rosary as this, instead of wearing it as a vain bijou."
"You seem to take a great deal of comfort in your prayers, Esther, and always come down looking quiet and satisfied. I wish I could."
"If Mademoiselle was a Catholic, she would find true comfort, but as that is not to be, it would be well if you went apart each day to meditate and pray, as did the good mistress whom I served before Madame. She had a little chapel, and in it found solacement for much trouble."
"Would it be right for me to do so, too?" asked Amy, who in her loneliness felt the need of help of some sort, and found that she was apt to forget her little book, now that Beth was not there to remind her of it.
"It would be excellent and charming, and I shall gladly arrange the little dressing-room for you, if you like it. Say nothing to Madame, but when she sleeps, go you and sit alone a while, to think good thoughts, and pray the dear God preserve your sister."
Esther was truly pious, and quite sincere in her advice, for she had an affectionate heart,
and felt much for the sisters in their anxiety. Amy liked the idea and gave her leave to arrange the light closet next her room, hoping it would do her good.
"I wish I knew where all these pretty things would go when Aunt March dies," she said, as she slowly replaced the shining rosary and shut the jewel cases one by one.
"To you and your sisters, I know it. Madame confides in me. I witnessed her will, and it is to be so," whispered Esther, smiling.
"How nice! But I wish she'd let us have them now. Procrastination is not agreeable," observed Amy, taking a last look at the diamonds.
"It is too soon yet for the young ladies to wear these things. The first one who is affianced will have the pearls, Madame has said it, and I have a fancy that a little turquoise ring will be given to you when you go, for Madame approves your good behavior and charming manners."
"Do you think so? Oh, I'll be a lamb, if I can only have that lovely ring. It's ever so much prettier than Kitty Brandt's. I do like Aunt March, after all."
And Amy tried on the blue ring, with a delighted face and a firm resolve to earn it. From that day, she was a model of obedience, and the old lady complacently admired the success of her training. Esther fitted up the closet with a little table, placed a footstool before it, and over it a picture, taken from one of the shut-up rooms. She thought it was of no great value, but being appropriate, she borrowed it, well knowing that Madame would never know it, nor care if she did. It was, however, a very valuable copy of one of the famous pictures of the world, and Amy's beauty-loving eyes were never tired of looking up at the sweet face of the Divine Mother, while her tender thoughts of her own were busy at her heart. On the table she laid her little testament and hymn book, kept a vase always full of the best flowers Lori brought her, and came every day to sit alone, thinking good thoughts and praying the dear God to preserve her sister. Esther had given her a rosary of black beads with a silver cross, but Amy hung it up and did not use it, feeling doubtful as to its fitness for Protestant prayers. The little girl was very sincere in all this, for being left alone outside the safe home nest, she felt the need of some kind hand to hold by, so sorely that she instinctively turned to the strong and tender friend whose fatherly love most closely surrounds his little children. She missed her mother's help to understand and rule herself, but having been taught where to look, she did her best to find the way and walk in it confidingly. But Amy was a young pilgrim, and just now her burden seemed very heavy. She tried to forget herself, to keep cheerful, and be satisfied with doing right, though no one saw or praised her for it. In her first effort at being very, very good, she decided to make her will, as Aunt March had done, so that if she did fall ill and die, her possessions might be justly and generously divided. It cost her a pang even to think of giving up the little treasures, which in her eyes were as precious as the old lady's jewels. During one of her play hours, she wrote out the important document as well as she could, with some help from Esther as to certain legal terms, and when the good-natured Frenchwoman had signed her name, Amy felt relieved and laid it by to show Lori, whom she wanted as a second witness. As it was a rainy day, she went upstairs to amuse herself in one of the large chambers and took Polly with her for company. In this room there was a wardrobe full of old-fashioned costumes with which Esther allowed her to play, and it was her favorite amusement to array herself in the faded brocades and parade up and down before the long mirror, making stately curtsies and sweeping her train about with a rustle which delighted her ears. So busy was she on this day that she did not hear Lori's ring, nor see his face peeping in at her, as she gravely promenaded to and fro, flirting her fan and tossing her head, on which she wore a great pink turban, contrasting oddly with her blue brocade dress and yellow quilted petticoat. She was obliged to walk carefully, for she had on high-heeled shoes, and, as Lori told Joe afterward, it was a comical sight to see her mince along in her gay suit, with Polly sidling and bridling just behind her, imitating her as well as he could, and occasionally stopping to laugh or exclaim,
"Ain't we fine? Get along, you fright. Hold your tongue. Kiss me, dear. Ha ha."
Having with difficulty restrained an explosion of merriment, lest it should offend Her Majesty, Lori tapped and was graciously received.
"Sit down and rest while I put these things away. Then I want to consult you about a very serious matter," said Amy, when she had shown her splendor and driven Polly into a corner. "That bird is the trial of my life," she continued, removing the pink mountain from her head,
while Laurie seated himself astride a chair.
Yesterday, when Aunt was asleep, and I was trying to be as still as a mouse, Polly began to squall and flap about in his cage, so I went to let him out and found a big spider there. I poked it out and it ran under the bookcase. Polly marched straight after it, stooped down and peeped under the bookcase, saying in his funny way, with a cock of his eye, "Come out and take a walk, my dear." I couldn't help laughing, which made Paul swear, and Aunt woke up and scolded us both.
"Did the spider accept the old fellow's invitation?" asked Laurie, yawning.
"Yes, out it came and away ran Polly, frightened to death, and scrambled up on Aunt's chair, calling out, "Catcher, catcher, catcher," as I chased the spider.
"That's a lie. Oh, Lor,"
cried the parrot, pecking at Laurie's toes.
"I'd wring your neck if you were mine, you old torment," cried Laurie, shaking his fist at the bird, who put his head on one side and gravely croaked,
"Hallelujah. Bless your buttons, dear."
"Now I'm ready," said Amy, shutting the wardrobe and taking a piece of paper out of her pocket. "I want you to read that, please, and tell me if it is legal and right. I felt I ought to do it, for life is uncertain, and I don't want any ill feeling over my tomb."
Laurie bit his lips, and turning a little from the pensive speaker, read the following document with praiseworthy gravity, considering the spelling.
"My last will and testament. I, Amy Curtis March, being in my sane mind, go give and bequeath thee all my earthly property, viz. To wit, namely to my father, my best pictures, sketches, maps, and works of art, including frames. Also my $100 to do what he likes with. To my mother all my clothes, except the blue apron with pockets, also my likeness, and my medal with much love. To my dear sister Margaret I give my turquoise ring, if I get it, also my green box with the doves on it, also my piece of real lace for her neck, and my sketch of her as a memorial of her little girl. To Joe I leave my breastpin, the one mended with sealing wax, also my bronze inkstand, she lost the cover, and my most precious plaster rabbit, because I am sorry I burned up her story. To Beth, if she lives after me, I give my dolls and the little bureau, my fan, my linen collars, and my new slippers, if she can wear them, being thin, when she gets well. And I herewith also leave her my regret that I ever made fun of old Joanna. To my friend and neighbor, Theodore Lawrence, I bequeath thee my papier-mâché portfolio, my clay model of a horse, though he did say it hadn't any neck. Also, in return for his great kindness in the hour of affliction, any one of my artistic works he likes. Notre Dame is the best. To our venerable benefactor, Mr. Lawrence, I leave my purple box with a looking-glass in the cover, which will be nice for his pens, and remind him of the departed girl who thanks him for his favors to her family, especially Beth. I wish my favorite playmate, Kitty Brandt, to have the blue silk apron and my gold bead ring with a kiss. To Hannah I give the bandbox she wanted, and all the patchwork I leave, hoping she will remember me when it you see. And now, having disposed of my most valuable property, I hope all will be satisfied and not blame the dead. I forgive everyone, and trust we may all meet when the trump shall sound. Amen. To this will and testament, I set my hand and seal on this 20th day of November, Annie Domino, 1861. Amy Curtis March. Witnesses Estelle Valnor, Theodore Lawrence.
The last name was written in pencil, and Amy explained that he was to rewrite it in ink and seal it up for her properly.
"What put it into your head? Did anyone tell you about Beth's giving away her things?" asked Laurie soberly, as Amy laid a bit of red tape with sealing wax, a taper, and a Standish before him. She explained and then asked anxiously,
"What about Beth?"
"I'm sorry I spoke, but as I did, I'll tell you. She felt so ill one day that she told Joe she wanted to give her piano to Meg, her cats to you, and the poor old doll to Joe, who would love it for her sake. She was sorry she had so little to give, and left locks of hair to the rest of us, and her best love to Grandpa. She never thought of a will."
Laurie was signing and sealing as he spoke, and did not look up till a great tear dropped on the paper. Amy's face was full of trouble, but she only said,
"Don't people put sort of postscripts to their wills sometimes?"
"Yes, codicils, they call them."
"Put one in mine, then, that I wish all my curls cut off and given round to my friends. I forgot it, but I want it done, though it will spoil my looks."
Laurie added it, smiling at Amy's last and greatest sacrifice. Then he amused her for an hour and was much interested in all her trials. But when he came to go, Amy held him back to whisper with trembling lips,
"Is there really any danger about Beth?"
"I'm afraid there is, but we must hope for the best, so don't cry, dear."
And Laurie put his arm about her with a brotherly gesture, which was very comforting. When he had gone, she went to her little chapel, and sitting in the twilight, prayed for Beth, with streaming tears and an aching heart, feeling that a million turquoise rings would not console her for the loss of her gentle little sister.
Chapter 20. Confidential. I don't think I have any words in which to tell the meeting of the mother and daughters. Such hours are beautiful to live, but very hard to describe, so I will leave it to the imagination of my readers, merely saying that the house was full of genuine happiness and that Meg's tender hope was realized, for when Beth woke from that long, healing sleep, the first objects on which her eyes fell were the little rose and mother's face. Too weak to wonder at anything, she only smiled and nestled close in the loving arms about her, feeling that the hungry longing was satisfied at last. Then she slept again, and the girls waited upon their mother, for she would not unclasp the thin hand which clung to hers, even in sleep. Hannah had dished up an astonishing breakfast for the traveler, finding it impossible to vent her excitement in any other way, and Meg and Joe fed their mother like dutiful young storks, while they listened to her whispered account of father's state, Mr. Brooks' promise to stay and nurse him, the delays which the storm occasioned on the homeward journey, and the unspeakable comfort Laurie's hopeful face had given her when she arrived, worn out with fatigue, anxiety, and cold. What a strange yet pleasant day that was, so brilliant and gay without, for all the world seemed abroad to welcome the first snow. So quiet and reposeful within, for everyone slept, spent with watching, and a Sabbath stillness reigned through the house, while nodding Hannah mounted guard at the door. With a blissful sense of burdens lifted off, Meg and Joe closed their weary eyes and lay at rest, like storm-beaten boats safe at anchor in a quiet harbor. Mrs. March would not leave Beth's side, but rested in the big chair, waking often to look at, touch, and brood over her child like a miser over some recovered treasure. Laurie, meanwhile, posted off to comfort Amy, and told his story so well that Aunt March actually sniffed herself and never once said, "I told you so." Amy came out so strong on this occasion that I think the good thoughts in the little chapel really began to bear fruit. She dried her tears quickly, restrained her impatience to see her mother, and never even thought of the turquoise ring, when the old lady heartily agreed in Laurie's opinion that she behaved like a capital little woman. Even Polly seemed impressed, for he called her a good girl, blessed her buttons, and begged her to
"come and take a walk, dear,"
in his most affable tone. She would very gladly have gone out to enjoy the bright, wintry weather, but discovering that Laurie was dropping with sleep, in spite of manful efforts to conceal the fact, she persuaded him to rest on the sofa while she wrote a note to her mother. She was a long time about it, and when she returned, he was stretched out with both arms under his head, sound asleep, while Aunt March had pulled down the curtains and sat doing nothing in an unusual fit of benignity. After a while, they began to think he was not going to wake up till night, and I'm not sure that he would, had he not been effectually roused by Amy's cry of joy at sight of her mother. There probably were a good many happy little girls in and about the city that day, but it is my private opinion that Amy was the happiest of all when she sat in her mother's lap and told her trials, receiving consolation and compensation in the shape of approving smiles and fond caresses. They were alone together in the chapel, to which her mother did not object when its purpose was explained to her. "On the contrary, I like it very much, dear." Looking from the dusty rosary to the well-worn little book and the lovely picture with its garland of evergreen. "It is an excellent plan to have some place where we can go to be quiet when things vex or grieve us. There are a good many hard times in this life of ours, but we can always bear them if we ask help in the right way. I think my little girl is learning this."
"Yes, Mother, and when I go home, I mean to have a corner in the big closet to put my books and the copy of that picture, which I've tried to make. The woman's face is not good. It's too beautiful for me to draw. But the baby's done better, and I love it very much. I like to think he was a little child once, for then I don't seem so far away, and that helps me."
As Amy pointed to the smiling Christ child on his mother's knee, Mrs. March saw something on the lifted hand that made her smile. She said nothing, but Amy understood the look, and after a minute's pause, she added gravely,
"I wanted to speak to you about this, but I forgot it. Aunt gave me the ring today. She called me to her and kissed me and put it on my finger and said I was a credit to her and she'd like to keep me always. She gave that funny guard to keep the turquoise on, as it's too big. I'd like to wear them, Mother. Can I?"
"They are very pretty, but I think you're rather too young for such ornaments, Amy," said Mrs. March, looking at the plump little hand with the band of sky-blue stones on the forefinger and the quaint guard formed of two tiny golden hands clasped together.
"I'll try not to be vain," said Amy. "I don't think I like it only because it's so pretty, but I want to wear it as the girl in the story wore her bracelet, to remind me of something."
"Do you mean Aunt March?" asked her mother, laughing.
"No, to remind me not to be selfish."
Amy looked so earnest and sincere about it that her mother stopped laughing and listened respectfully to the little plan.
"I've thought a great deal lately about my bundle of naughties, and being selfish is the largest one in it, so I'm going to try hard to cure it, if I can. Beth isn't selfish, and that's the reason everyone loves her and feels so bad at the thoughts of losing her. People wouldn't feel so bad about me if I was sick, and I don't deserve to have them, but I'd like to be loved and missed by a great many friends, so I'm going to try and be like Beth all I can. I'm apt to forget my resolutions, but if I had something always about me to remind me, I guess I should do better. May we try this way?"
"Yes, but I have more faith in the corner of the big closet. Wear your ring, dear, and do your best. I think you will prosper, for the sincere wish to be good is half the battle. Now, I must go back to Beth. Keep up your heart, little daughter, and we will soon have you home again." That evening, while Meg was writing to her father to report the traveler's safe arrival, Jo slipped upstairs into Beth's room, and finding her mother in her usual place, stood a minute, twisting her fingers in her hair, with a worried gesture and an undecided look.
"What is it, dearie?" asked Mrs. March, holding out her hand with a face which invited confidence.
"I want to tell you something, Mother."
"About Meg?"
"How quickly you guessed. Yes, it's about her, and though it's a little thing, it fidgets me."
"Beth is asleep. Speak low and tell me all about it. That Moffat hasn't been here, I hope?" asked Mrs. March rather sharply.
"No, I should have shut the door in his face if he had," said Jo, settling herself on the floor at her mother's feet. "Last summer Meg left a pair of gloves over at the Lawrences, and only one was returned. We forgot about it till Teddy told me that Mr. Brooke owned that he liked Meg, but didn't dare say so, she was so young and he so poor. Now, isn't it a dreadful state of things?"
"Do you think Meg cares for him?" asked Mrs. March, with an anxious look.
"Mercy me, I don't know anything about love and such nonsense," cried Jo, with a funny mixture of interest and contempt. "In novels, the girls show it by starting and blushing, feigning away, growing thin, and acting like fools. Now, Meg does not do anything of the sort. She eats and drinks and sleeps like a sensible creature. She looks straight in my face when I talk about that man, and only blushes a little bit when Teddy jokes about lovers. I forbid him to do it, but he doesn't mind me as he ought."
"Then you fancy that Meg is not interested in John?"
"Who?" cried Jo, staring.
"Mr. Brooke. I call him John now. We fell into the way of doing so at the hospital, and he likes it."
"Oh, dear, I know you'll take his part. He's been good to Father, and you won't send him away but let Meg marry him, if she wants to. Mean thing, to go petting Papa and helping you, just to wheedle you into liking him."
And Jo pulled her hair again with a wrathful tweak.
"My dear, don't get angry about it, and I will tell you how it happened. John went with me at Mr. Lawrence's request, and was so devoted to poor Father that we couldn't help getting fond of him. He was perfectly open and honorable about Meg, for he told us he loved her, but would earn a comfortable home before he asked her to marry him. He only wanted our leave to love her and work for her, and the right to make her love him if he could. He is a truly excellent young man, and we could not refuse to listen to him, but I will not consent to Meg's engaging herself so young."
"Of course not.
It would be idiotic. I knew there was mischief brewing. I felt it, and now it's worse than I imagined. I just wish I could marry Meg myself and keep her safe in the family."
This odd arrangement made Mrs. March smile, but she said gravely, "Joe, I confide in you and don't wish you to say anything to Meg yet. When John comes back and I see them together, I can judge better of her feelings toward him."
"She'll see those handsome eyes that she talks about, and then it will be all up with her. She's got such a soft heart, it will melt like butter in the sun if anyone looks sentimentally at her. She read the short reports he sent more than she did your letters, and pinched me when I spoke of it, and likes brown eyes, and doesn't think John an ugly name, and she'll go and fall in love, and there's an end of peace and fun and cozy times together. I see it all. They'll go lovering around the house, and we shall have to dodge. Meg will be absorbed and no good to me anymore. Brooke will scratch up a fortune somehow, carry her off, and make a hole in the family, and I shall break my heart, and everything will be abominably uncomfortable. Oh, dear me. Why weren't we all boys? Then there wouldn't be any bother."
Joe leaned her chin on her knees in a disconsolate attitude and shook her fist at the reprehensible John. Mrs. March sighed, and Joe looked up with an air of relief.
"You don't like it, Mother? I'm glad of it. Let's send him about his business and not tell Meg a word of it, but all be happy together as we always have been."
"I did wrong to sigh, Joe. It is natural and right you should all go to homes of your own in time, but I do want to keep my girls as long as I can, and I am sorry that this happened so soon, for Meg is only 17, and it will be some years before John can make a home for her. Your father and I have agreed that she shall not bind herself in any way, nor be married before 20. If she and John love one another, they can wait, and test the love by doing so. She is conscientious, and I have no fear of her treating him unkindly. My pretty, tender-hearted girl, I hope things will go happily with her."
"Hadn't you rather have her marry a rich man?" asked Joe,
as her mother's voice faltered a little over the last words. "Money is a good and useful thing, Joe, and I hope my girls will never feel the need of it too bitterly, not to be tempted by too much. I should like to know that John was firmly established in some good business, which gave him an income large enough to keep free from debt and make Meg comfortable. I am not ambitious for a splendid fortune, a fashionable position, or a great name for my girls. If rank and money come with love and virtue also, I should accept them gratefully and enjoy your good fortune, but I know, by experience, how much genuine happiness can be had in a plain little house, where the daily bread is earned and some privations give sweetness to the few pleasures. I am content to see Meg begin humbly, for if I am not mistaken, she will be rich in the possession of a good man's heart, and that is better than a fortune."
"I understand, Mother, and quite agree, but I'm disappointed about Meg, for I'd planned to have her marry Teddy by and by and sit in the lap of luxury all her days. Wouldn't it be nice?" asked Joe, looking up with a brighter face.
"He is younger than she, you know," began Mrs. March, but Joe broke in.
"Only a little. He's old for his age, and tall, and can be quite grown up in his manners, if he likes. Then he's rich and generous and good, and loves us all, and I say it's a pity my plan is spoiled."
"I'm afraid Lori is hardly grown up enough for Meg, and altogether too much of a weathercock just now for anyone to depend on. Don't make plans, Joe, but let time and their own hearts mate your friends. We can't meddle safely in such matters, and I better not get romantic rubbish, as you call it, into our heads, lest it spoil our friendship."
"Well, I won't, but I hate to see things going all crisscross and getting snarled up, when a pull here and a snip there would straighten it out. I wish wearing flat irons on our heads would keep us from growing up. But buds will be roses and kittens cats, more's the pity."
"What's that about flat irons and cats?" asked Meg, as she crept into the room with a finished letter in her hand.
"Only one of my stupid speeches. I'm going to bed. Come, Peggy," said Joe, unfolding herself like an animated puzzle.
"Quite right and beautifully written. Please add that I send my love to John," said Mrs. March, as she glanced over the letter and gave it back.
"Do you call him John?" asked Meg, smiling, with her innocent eyes looking down into her mother's.
"Yes, he has been like a son to us, and we are very fond of him," replied Mrs. March, returning the look with a keen one. "I'm glad of that. He is so lonely. Good night, Mother dear. It is so inexpressibly comfortable to have you here," was Meg's answer. The kiss her mother gave her was a very tender one, and as she went away, Mrs. March said, with a mixture of satisfaction and regret, "She does not love John yet, but will soon learn to." Chapter 21. Lori makes mischief, and Joe makes peace. Joe's face was a study next day, for the secret rather weighed upon her, and she found it hard not to look mysterious and important. Meg observed it, but did not trouble herself to make inquiries, for she had learned that the best way to manage Joe was by the law of contraries, so she felt sure of being told everything if she did not ask. She was rather surprised, therefore, when the silence remained unbroken, and Joe assumed a patronizing air, which decidedly aggravated Meg, who in turn assumed an air of dignified reserve and devoted herself to her mother. This left Joe to her own devices, for Mrs. March had taken her place as nurse and bade her rest, exercise, and amuse herself after her long confinement. Amy being gone, Lori was her only refuge, and much as she enjoyed his society, she rather dreaded him just then, for he was an incorrigible tease, and she feared he would coax the secret from her. She was quite right, for the mischief-loving lad no sooner suspected a mystery than he set himself to find it out, and led Joe a trying life of it. He wheedled, bribed, ridiculed, threatened, and scolded. Affected indifference, that he might surprise the truth from her, declared he knew, then that he didn't care, and at last, by dint of perseverance, he satisfied himself that it concerned Meg and Mr. Brooke. Feeling indignant that he was not taken into his tutor's confidence, he set his wits to work to devise some proper retaliation for the slight. Meg, meanwhile, had apparently forgotten the matter, and was absorbed in preparations for her father's return. But all of a sudden a change seemed to come over her, and for a day or two she was quite unlike herself. She started when spoken to, blushed when looked at, was very quiet, and sat over her sewing with a timid, troubled look on her face. To her mother's inquiries she answered that she was quite well, and Joe's she silenced by begging to be let alone. "She feels it in the air. Love, I mean, and she's going very fast. She's got most of the symptoms, is twittery and cross, doesn't eat, lies awake and mopes in corners. I caught her singing that song he gave her, and once she said, 'John, as you do,' and then turned as red as a poppy. 'Whatever shall we do?' said Joe, looking ready for any measures, however violent. 'Nothing but wait. Let her alone. Be kind and patient, and Father's coming will settle everything,' replied her mother. 'Here's a note to you, Meg, all sealed up.' 'How odd! Teddy never seals mine,' said Joe next day, as she distributed the contents of the little post office. Mrs. March and Joe were deep in their own affairs when a sound from Meg made them look up to see her staring at her note with a frightened face. "My child, what is it?" cried her mother, running to her, while Joe tried to take the paper which had done the mischief. "It's all a mistake. He didn't send it. Oh, Joe, how could you do it?" And Meg hid her face in her hands, crying as if her heart were quite broken. "Me? I've done nothing. What's she talking about?" cried Joe, bewildered. Meg's mild eyes kindled with anger as she pulled a crumpled note from her pocket and threw it at Joe, saying reproachfully, "You wrote it, and that bad boy helped you. How could you be so rude, so mean and cruel to us both?" Joe hardly heard her, for she and her mother were reading the note, which was written in a peculiar hand.
"My dearest Margaret, I can no longer restrain my passion, and must know my fate before I return. I dare not tell your parents yet, but I think they would consent if they knew that we adored one another. Mr. Lawrence will help me to some good place, and then, my sweet girl, you will make me happy. I implore you to say nothing to your family yet, but to send one word of hope through Lori to your devoted John."
"Oh, the little villain! That's the way he meant to pay me for keeping my word to mother. I'll give him a hearty scolding and bring him over to beg pardon," cried Joe, burning to execute immediate justice. But her mother held her back, saying, with a look she seldom wore,
"Stop, Joe. You must clear yourself first. You have played so many pranks that I'm afraid you have had a hand in this."
"On my word, Mother, I haven't.
I never saw that note before, and don't know anything about it, as true as I live," said Joe, so earnestly that they believed her. "If I had taken part in it, I'd have done it better than this, and have written a sensible note. I should think you'd have known Mr. Brooke wouldn't write such stuff as that," she added, scornfully tossing down the paper.
"It's like his writing," faltered Meg, comparing it with the note in her hand.
"Oh, Meg, you didn't answer it," cried Mrs. March quickly.
"Yes, I did,"
and Meg hid her face again, overcome with shame. "Here's a scrape. Do let me bring that wicked boy over to explain and be lectured. I can't rest till I get hold of him." And Joe made for the door again.
"Hush, let me handle this, for it is worse than I thought. Margaret, tell me the whole story," commanded Mrs. March,
sitting down by Meg, yet keeping hold of Joe, lest she should fly off.
"I received the first letter from Lori, who didn't look as if he knew anything about it," began Meg, without looking up. "I was worried at first and meant to tell you. Then I remembered how you liked Mr. Brooke, so I thought you wouldn't mind if I kept my little secret for a few days. I'm so silly that I like to think no one knew, and while I was deciding what to say, I felt like the girls in books who have such things to do. Forgive me, Mother. I'm paid for my silliness now. I never can look him in the face again."
"What did you say to him?" asked Mrs. March.
"I only said I was too young to do anything about it yet, that I didn't wish to have secrets from you, and he must speak to Father. I was very grateful for his kindness, and would be his friend, but nothing more, for a long while."
Mrs. March smiled, as if well pleased, and Joe clapped her hands, exclaiming with a laugh, "You were almost equal to Caroline Percy, who was a pattern of prudence. Tell on, Meg. What did he say to that?"
"He writes in a different way entirely, telling me that he never sent any love letter at all, and is very sorry that my roguish sister, Joe, should take liberties with our names. It's very kind and respectful, but think how dreadful for me."
Meg leaned against her mother, looking the image of despair, and Joe tramped about the room calling Lori names. All of a sudden she stopped, caught up the two notes, and after looking at them closely, said decidedly,
"I don't believe Brooke ever saw either of these letters. Teddy wrote both, and keeps yours to crow over me with, because I wouldn't tell him my secret."
"Don't have any secrets, Joe. Tell it to Mother and keep out of trouble, as I should have done," said Meg warningly.
"Bless you, child. Mother told me."
"That will do, Joe. I'll comfort Meg while you go and get Lori. I shall sift the matter to the bottom and put a stop to such pranks at once."
Away ran Joe, and Mrs. March gently told Meg Mr. Brooke's real feelings. "Now, dear, what are your own? Do you love him enough to wait till he can make a home for you, or will you keep yourself quite free for the present?"
"I've been so scared and worried, I don't want to have anything to do with lovers for a long while, perhaps never," answered Meg petulantly. "If John doesn't know anything about this nonsense, don't tell him, and make Joe and Lori hold their tongues. I won't be deceived and plagued and made a fool of. It's a shame."
Seeing Meg's usually gentle temper was roused, and her pride hurt by this mischievous joke, Mrs. March soothed her by promises of entire silence and great discretion for the future. The instant Lori's step was heard in the hall, Meg fled into the study, and Mrs. March received the culprit alone. Joe had not told him why he was wanted, fearing he wouldn't come, but he knew the minute he saw Mrs. March's face, and stood twirling his hat with a guilty air, which convicted him at once. Joe was dismissed, but chose to march up and down the hall like a sentinel, having some fear that the prisoner might bolt. The sound of voices in the parlor rose and fell for half an hour, but what happened during that interview, the girls never knew. When they were called in, Lori was standing by their mother with such a penitent face that Joe forgave him on the spot, but did not think it wise to betray the fact. Meg received his humble apology and was much comforted by the assurance that Brooke knew nothing of the joke.
"I'll never tell him to my dying day. Wild horses shan't drag it out of me. So you'll forgive me, Meg, and I'll do anything to show how out and out sorry I am," he added, looking very much ashamed of himself.
"I'll try, but it was a very ungentlemanly thing to do. I didn't think you could be so sly and malicious, Lori," replied Meg, trying to hide her maidenly confusion under a gravely reproachful air.
It was altogether abominable, and I don't deserve to be spoken to for a month. But you will, though, won't you?
And Lori folded his hands together with such an imploring gesture, as he spoke in his irresistibly persuasive tone, that it was impossible to frown upon him, in spite of his scandalous behavior. Meg pardoned him, and Mrs. March's grave face relaxed, in spite of her efforts to keep sober, when she heard him declare that he would atone for his sins by all sorts of penances, and abase himself like a worm before the injured damsel. Jo stood aloof, meanwhile, trying to harden her heart against him, and succeeding only in primming up her face into an expression of entire disapprobation. Lori looked at her once or twice, but as she showed no sign of relenting, he felt injured and turned his back on her till the others were done with him, when he made her a low bow and walked off without a word. As soon as he had gone, she wished she had been more forgiving, and when Meg and her mother went upstairs, she felt lonely and longed for Teddy. After resisting for some time, she yielded to the impulse and, armed with a book to return, went over to the big house. "Is Mr. Lawrence in?" asked Jo of a housemaid who was coming downstairs. "Yes, miss, but I don't believe he's seeable just yet." "Why not? Is he ill?" "La, no, miss, but he's had a scene with Mr. Lorry, who was in one of his tantrums about something, which vexes the old gentleman, so I dursn't go nigh him."
"Where is Lorry?"
"Shut up in his room, and he won't answer, though I've been a-tapping. I don't know what's to become of the dinner, for it's ready, and there's no one to eat it."
"I'll go and see what the matter is. I'm not afraid of either of them."
Up went Jo and knocked smartly on the door of Lori's little study.
"Stop that, or I'll open the door and make you," called out the young gentleman in a threatening tone.
Jo immediately knocked again. The door flew open, and in she bounced before Lori could recover from his surprise. Seeing that he really was out of temper, Jo, who knew how to manage him, assumed a contrite expression, and going artistically down upon her knees, said meekly,
"Please forgive me for being so cross. I came to make it up, and can't go away till I have."
"It's all right. Get up, and don't be a goose, Jo," was the cavalier reply to her petition.
"Thank you, I will. Could I ask what's the matter? You don't look exactly easy in your mind."
"I've been shaken, and I won't bear it," growled Lori indignantly.
"Who did it?" demanded Jo.
"Grandfather. If it had been anyone else, I'd have..."
And the injured youth finished his sentence by an energetic gesture of the right arm.
"That's nothing. I often shake you, and you don't mind," said Jo soothingly.
"Pooh! You're a girl, and it's fun, but I'll allow no man to shake me."
"I don't think anyone would care to try it, if you looked as much like a thundercloud as you do now. Why were you treated so?"
"Just because I wouldn't say what your mother wanted me for. I'd promised not to tell, and of course I wasn't going to break my word."
"Couldn't you satisfy your grandpa in any other way?"
"No, he would have the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I'd have told my part of the scrape if I could without bringing Megan. As I couldn't, I held my tongue and bore the scolding, till the old gentleman collared me. Then I bolted, for fear I should forget myself."
"It wasn't nice, but he's sorry, I know, so go down and make up. I'll help you."
"Hanged if I do. I'm not going to be lectured and pummeled by everyone, just for a bit of a frolic. I was sorry about Meg, and begged pardon like a man, but I won't do it again when I wasn't in the wrong."
"He didn't know that."